Gifted Talks Fundraising offers you a seat at the table for a relaxed chat about what it takes to build successful giving programs. Marshalling decades of practical hands-on experience, the Gifted Directors provide helpful advice and top tips for achieving your fundraising goals. Welcome back. Here we are, Gifted Talks Fundraising, and it's really good to, you know, drag Chris Goldie off the golf course and Amy Stevens down the M1 again. As we are in Leamington Spa, centre of the universe. But today, I think we've got a really challenging topic to discuss, and that's really around, is fundraising an investment or a cost? And how do you go about approaching that question with your finance director, bursar, purse strings keeper, to win the argument and understand how best this resource can be deployed? It's a real life situation we're facing with a number of clients at the moment, as naturally people are reflecting on and going through their budgets with great care, as they do every year, but most particularly, I think, when times have been as challenging as they have been at the moment. Don't you love that word, challenging? But Chris, you're particularly, I think, just thinking through some of your school's experience presently. I mean, how are you approaching this in advising your clients just at the moment about the cost or investment? Where do you see that question, and how's it being answered?
Well, the choice of words is really important here, isn't it, between cost and investment. You know, bursars will see the expenditure on a development department being a cost, and it is a cost. It goes in the operational cost expenditure sheet in the accounts. But the reality is it's an investment, because if you don't invest, you're never going to raise the money. And if you're going to invest, we know the most expensive part of investment is in people. You've got to make sure you're investing in the right people to deliver the right strategy at the right time. And that very often involves engaging consultancies like us as an investment in the future fundraising success that you're likely to have or you want to have. And it's very hard, I think, in the current climate to have ambition but not have the wherewithal to be able to afford that ambition. Yeah. And I think how I've been speaking to schools very often is, you know, you cannot get rid of your fundraising department, otherwise you're just going to stand still. And
yeah, we've seen that happen.
I was going to say, we've all worked in different times, in times of financial crisis, through COVID. You know, we had categoric proof when we did the IDP benchmarking report that those schools who stopped completely during COVID took a lot longer to recover and get back to their previous fundraising.
This is where, effectively, because COVID came and they had to totally re-engineer how they delivered their education service, they decided, right, we'll take the fundraisers, we'll make them redundant, and we'll stop our development office.
Exactly that.
And so they're the ones that took a much longer, obviously, to get their income back up and so on. Yeah.
Well, it's not just the monetary element either, is it's the relationships and the communications with your donors and all that goodwill and, you know, taking people along that donor journey, as we say, is when that stops, you start again from scratch, don't you?
Yeah, and it comes back to, you know, what sits at the heart of successful fundraising? It's having great relationships with your prospective donors. Mm. You know, and if you don't have the people on hand, and this isn't just schools, this is any organisation, if you don't have people to build those personal relationships, you're simply not going to be able to fundraise effectively. You cannot rely on a database and, you know, the odd thank you email or message to do the job that a one-to-one conversation might have between a person representing the institution and a prospective donor.
Fair point. Amy, but we've seen, haven't we? I mean, in fact, we both worked with a cathedral client that had two really ace fundraisers. Mm-hmm. And had invested in them. They'd been developed nicely over the previous 4 or 5 years and were really, really bringing in the money. Of course, the cathedral hits a financial crisis. They're required by the church commissioners to cut their costs. And what do?
I know. Who's first to go, right?
They sacked both their fundraisers.
And the problem with that is that, you know, they'd built such good relationships. When it came to reigniting fundraising, it was really quite difficult because those people who'd almost become friends with those fundraisers, they'd seen them that often.
Of course.
You know, felt like they'd been, you know, thrown to the gutter almost, and they'd given cash and
did they just think the money was going to continue to come in? Do you think that they thought, well, if we get rid of the staff, it doesn't matter, the givers will just keep giving?
I think potentially, you know, there are situations, aren't there, where the bigger challenge just kind of eclipses everything else and you don't necessarily think about the longer term ramifications of it. But we should do, shouldn't we, when we're thinking about longer term forecasts.
But isn't it the risk, though, and you see this in business as well, when the accountants take control of a business, everything is run through a spreadsheet, and you can almost guarantee that if only the only thing you're doing is managing costs, you're just managing the decline or closure of the business, because you still you need to be focused on the vision. And we've talked about this, haven't we? And I'm just reflecting again on that particular cathedral situation. Once that mindset was in there, it's still there. And they've not, the financial challenges have not gone away.
Yeah.
But they're just not bringing the same levels of investment and income in.
It's like a sales business, isn't it? Commercially, if you don't invest in your sales team, you're not going to sell any product.
I think that it's that terrible cliche of speculating to accumulate, isn't it? At the end of the day, and the reality is fundraising is not an exact science. You can't, it's not like selling nuts and bolts. You don't know how many you should be selling in a year to meet your target. You might one day, you know, stumble across a major donor who gives you £250,000. Or you might spend a year not finding one major donor who'll give you £250,000.
That's a really good point. So I'm the bursar of a school in this sort of situation. How do you convince me that it's worth investing in my development office? You know, and I'm going to say to myself, well, I don't really know when the return's going to come in for that investment. It could be years away in the case of a legacy. And it could be lots of small gifts or some big gifts. How do you give me confidence as a bursar that that's a good investment at the size that is possibly necessary?
Well, so I think a lot of this comes down to having a realistic, effective strategy in place that's deliverable, that you have a team of people or one person, depending on the size of the strategy, the ambition of the strategy, but you have the right mechanisms in place to deliver a strategy that is not based on a thumb in the air, we should be able to raise 3 million quid, is actually based upon some hard statistical evidence, some conversations, whether that's through feasibility study or just on a private one-to-one basis, that actually says this is what was achievable, this is what people are going to support, and then the way you judge it, I think, going forward as a bursar or as a finance director, is your KPIs are not shouldn't just be about how much money's raised, but how many meetings you've had, how many times you've got together with other people.
So KPIs, how many people signed up to the newsletter?
How many people open your emails? How many people respond?
There are measurables for key performance indicators that are there that you can plan and set out in advance that will indicate whether this is an investment that's giving you a return or will give you a return.
I think that's the key thing. You know, if you've got a fundraising director who says that they will meet 50 high net worth prospects in a 6 month period, and then you go back to them and say, well, how many you've met? And they said 10, then they're not doing their job properly.
Yeah. So they talk about that sometimes as a pipeline, don't they?
Absolutely.
A prospect pipeline. So okay, meetings is a key one. What other KPIs, Amy, would you have on your performance list?
One we see a lot is just data acquisition. So people say, well, we've got no regular giving. We need to get people to sign up for regular giving. I was like, okay. Well, you've got no database. So what we need to do, first of all, is acquire those people and get them to actually sign up to your communications.
Obvious but clear, issue there.
And obviously that, it raises a little money because sometimes people kind of just proactively give. But it's about building that relationship with a new cohort of people that you can then communicate to and take on that journey to regular giving. So, you know, that can be challenging to present to trustees and bursars and FDs of charities when you say, actually, we don't plan to raise any money for the next 9 months. We plan to acquire new supporters.
And add that.
Yeah.
And we can
who
that.
We can cultivate. Yeah.
So I'm aware of somebody having a job interview very recently where, as the pre-interview task, they were asked to predict how much money they would raise in the first year in job.
Oh, great.
Wow.
They come with the magic wand and a tutu.
Absolutely. So they rang me it was an old client of mine, and rang me for some advice. I said, well, you can't give them the figure. You're going to explain how you will set about creating a strategy that hopefully will deliver X in the future. But sitting here, not knowing anything about the organisation, not even working for the organisation, you're just going to look silly if you say, I'll raise you £500,000, and then you get there and realise that that's impossible in year one.
But there's all sorts of key performance indicators that are really very solid for giving you forward income projections. just to set out some examples, I mean, your question about acquiring donors, well, then convert, how many of those can you convert to their first gift? It may not be their biggest gift or their lifetime giving, but their first gift. So we could, there's a conversion KPI there. Then there's that old sort of, remember, moves management? There's a strategy. How do you then move your first time giver to be a pledged giver or to just simply give again? There's another KPI in relation to that. And then there's all questions around site raising KPIs. How do you increase your £100 donor to be a £1,000 donor or and so on? And they're all measurable but require different tools to get there, don't they? So a bursar that is looking at a spreadsheet and is wanting to know that this investment is going to pay off really needs to design some killer KPIs to give that assurance to their finance committee.
But it's not say it's not just schools, it's any charitable organisation. Yeah. We still have, you know, a lot of trustees still have this old-fashioned notion that people should fundraise for nothing and it's all for charity. And, you know, and the reality is fundraising is a business like any other these days. Mm-hmm. It relies on a different instinct. As I said, you're not selling a product, but what you are doing is selling an ambition, a vision, a dream, or in some cases you're answering an emergency type appeal. And we know that emergency appeals in this country are very well supported, but it's lower level. And we equally know that to be truly effective as fundraising, you need to be focusing in an area which is going to produce the most revenue for you from a relatively small number of people. And the only way you do that is by having relationships, and the only way you can build relationships is by having the people in place who can create and maintain those relationships.
So in a straitened economic situation, which some might describe our current macro position to be in, It's yes, you've got to invest in the right people. You've got to set out the right KPIs, as we discussed, measurable ways of determining whether that investment's being well placed and is the plan being delivered. But there's something in what you just said there, Chris, about there needing to be a strong and compelling vision, something that addresses the current situation. I'm going to stay with schools, but very popular at the moment is about bursaries and where people are finding it tough to keep their kids, let's say, in an independent school. Bursaries are a very positive way of answering that. It's a strong vision that you can use. Is that what you're seeing out there, the vision being a key part of this?
I think it's very interesting. When you talk to major gift prospects around bursaries, what genuinely motivates people, I think, is the ability to fund somebody who has absolutely zero chance of going to that private school and getting that level of education. Mm. So I think you see from major donors far greater support for the I will pay for somebody's education for a period of X number of years, more so than the, well, you know, if we raise this amount of money, we could pay the VAT that 50, that's it doesn't, you know. So I think we've got to be very careful how we say it. And some boards of governors I know are falling into that trap of going, well, we don't want to lose numbers, so if we could pay the VAT through bursaries, but then they're forgetting the donors aren't interested in that.
It's a bad impact.
So you've got to have, you know, and again, this comes back to why you must view fundraising as an investment, because you need professional people doing that job and taking that message and having that conversation.
In a similar vein, Amy, on vision, I mean, I'm just thinking about some of the animal and animal welfare charities. Tough times means people are doing things, giving up their pets and putting them out on the street, all sorts of things. I mean, that's a heart-rending situation, but it's real and it's happening in our community right here. I mean, the vision is a really important part. I'm not beyond schools, isn't it?
Well, with any charity, it's the most important thing, isn't it? Having that case for support. Why do you need to get behind us? Even if, like I say, the first step is signing up to a newsletter, it's getting them engaged in that vision and what you're trying to achieve and the impact, isn't it?
If you take that donor journey, as Amy's just said, it starts with a newsletter, and maybe you said it's that little gift, the couple of quid a month, first gift, and then you build. Somebody's got to do that work.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just let that happen, evolve naturally, because it isn't. Because individually as donors, if we don't get asked, if we don't get reminded, if we don't feel valued, we'll just stop.
Well, it's time and time again, we see these fundraising survey results coming back. And one of the questions that's invariably put is, have you been a giver? And if not, why not? And the number one answer is because no one asked me.
Yeah.
So if you don't have someone responsible for your development, they're not managing the whole process of asking and engaging, and so that you're not going to get the money in, obviously. It's not just going to fall on your lap. But it's the other point is they need to keep the relationships within the organisation, Amy, don't they, and get the whole focus, if you like, on generating that philanthropic income.
They do. It's about ownership, isn't it? So we see it with those clients of ours where the entire team understands fundraising. And the, you know, the chief exec gets behind it.
It's not a silo over there.
Yeah, yeah, not just, oh, the fundraising team will deal with it. People understand its value and people understand they all need to own it and play their role. And I think in that kind of situation, it's a lot easier than to kind of justify, even though we don't need to justify it, but justify that investment in fundraising. But a great example, which touches upon what you were just saying before, Andrew, was a current client of mine where we're doing a feasibility study for a capital campaign. They have never done capital fundraising, but their community engagement has been top notch. So their social following is huge. They're really good with their newsletters and communicating to their current donors and supporters. And the results we've then had on the survey for support for the capital campaign have been fantastic because their supporters feel loved, they feel informed, they know what impact they're having. And they're ready to go to that next stage now.
But equally, they are. But what do you need to take them to the next stage? You need to have the personal interaction.
Yeah, yeah.
Because again, this whole business about keeping people informed. I know some people, some clients out there or ex-clients out there who go, well, that's all right. We'll just send them a newsletter every 2 months. And when, you know, then when we have an appeal, they'll send us some money.
Yeah.
And yeah, there may be a few
who
will send you £5.
Yeah.
That's fine. But if you're trying to raise 3 million,
I know. It's a lot of fivers.
It's a lot of fivers you need. And that's, you're only going to build that up if you've got the relationships.
Yeah.
And the reality is in tough times, and it's again going back to schools, you know, head teachers, bursars, they're all under huge pressure at the moment, huge financial challenges. Add on to that, actually, it's now your responsibility to fundraise as well. So our top 50 clients, although who's identified those top 50 clients without a development department, not sure who's doing that piece of work. But let's say you've got a list of top 50 clients and now you're saying to the head, oh, and by the way, head, you've now got to go and meet all of these people in an exploratory fashion because they're not just going to give you money
to start building that relationship.
To start, but they haven't got the time to do that.
No.
So unless you have somebody who's got the time to do that, you're simply, and that works for universities, it works in hospitals, it works everywhere where you need to build major gift relationships.
So the difference between costs and investment, to my mind, is a cost is something that needs to be managed and if minimized as wherever possible to get the return you're looking for, to get the outcome you're looking for, the service delivered or whatever. An investment is something that you want to get the maximum result from. So it's very much about focusing on, firstly, will it cover its costs? Many fail to appreciate that a development office function should, in effect, and can, is very often fully funded by the gift aid receipts that come in as a result of the gifts that are solicited, let alone the gifts themselves, which are all cream on the cake, so to speak. So they should be washing their face. One of the ROIs is, when is the break-even moment for your development office? And if you really analyse costs related to development and then shape up and see the returns as an investment, you are finding a very good multiple, normally 3 to 4 times. And the IDP survey, I think, demonstrated 2.5, was it, on an average?
Well, I think what the IDP, certainly the one that we did, the one's just being completed now, but the one that we did 3 years ago showed very clearly that you need to invest to get a reasonable ROI. And those organisations that had larger teams that had been around longer and were therefore spending more money on their fundraising were actually the ones whose ROIs were up above £5 or £6 pounds for
But the average raised team was 3, wasn't it?
The average team was about 2.5 full FTEs.
Yeah.
You know, and that was covering everything. And if they'd been around for 3 to 6 years, you could start to see there was a sort of 3 times multiple on investment starting to come through, and that was only going to grow. Cut that off, you're starting again. And the other side of that coin, those organisations that were just starting their fundraising, they're having to pay the salary, but they haven't built the relationship. They're not getting the money back at all.
How long was it taking them before they got to break even?
Well, those surveys worked on a sort of 0 to 3 years,
okay,
4 to 6 year type basis. Yeah. And it was really only in most cases, in 4 to 6 years, where you're starting to see what I'd call a good regular return. It changes a bit when there's a capital campaign. Organisations will dive into a capital campaign. Yeah. But
no. Don't you think it depends as well, though, on an organisational leadership understanding of the different types of fundraising as well? So how often do we see we're going to have a big gala dinner? You're going to invite 200 people to it?
Just remind us of the three types of, so just for the benefit of those.
So obviously we can have, you know, major gifts fundraising, which in theory has a much higher ROI versus community fundraising. So like the events and
Which is your annual sort of fundraising activity.
And obviously you've got legacies and whatnot in the future. But, you know, we have those examples of we'll hold a gala dinner, not realising that it's going to take one individual 6 months of their full-time job to arrange that and deliver that gala dinner. And actually, had they focused on cultivating five high net worths and asking them properly, they probably could have raised five times as much.
Oh, easily, yes.
So I think sometimes there's organisational understanding of investment and where it needs to be to have the right results. And sometimes the gala dinner is the route you want to take because you're trying to engage mass numbers of people.
But I also think this has an impact on investment decisions because a lot of organisations will say, oh, we had a fundraiser and they didn't raise any money, so we're not going to do it again. Yes. Mm. What probably happened is they recruited somebody who said they were a fundraiser and maybe were very good at, let's say, events fundraising, when actually what the organisation really wanted was a major gifts fundraiser who would go out and cultivate their top 20 or 30 prospects.
Yeah.
And for me, it's a valid investment if you're recruiting to the strategy that you set out to achieve.
So just going back, because you did say this earlier, and just for the benefit of our listeners, it's important to have a plan, understanding the three types of fundraising, annual, capital and endowment, and the different tools that you use for each. We've covered this off in a different podcast, but it's there in the book as well. But specifically for the annual fundraising that, like you're referring to, Amy, where there's events, sometimes they basically break even.
Yeah.
But the point is you've got a really good, because the KPI you're doing is you're now have got a whole lot of new relationships and new donors on that list. So it's worth it for that reason, even if you don't raise any money. But very often annual fundraising can be 60 to 80% of what you bring in is spent to get there. So that's worth bearing in mind. Capital fundraising, on the other hand, something very specific that like a building or whatever, it's 5 to 15% of the total that you raise in general terms is spent on that. Whereas legacies, endowment based fundraising can be 2 to 4% of the total amount that you bring in. But if you don't have an understanding of how they all fit together and your plan, you're never going to be able to manage that investment effectively.
I think that's the crucial bit, is that strategic element and what is your overarching strategy? So like you say, sometimes with community, it would barely cover the salaries of your community team. But, you know, you've got person X who works in community at a hospital and they're there cheering on the people who are taking part in the half marathon and whatnot. And then somebody who ran the half marathon goes to their business and introduces you, and then you get a £25,000 corporate gift because you invested in that.
Yeah.
So like you say, it's how they all link together, isn't it, as part of the wider strategy.
I was going to say, it's almost like we're dissing I've been dissing every other type of fundraising. I'm not. I think they all have a really valid part to play in that overall fundraising mix. But the reality is, if you don't have the right staff doing the right jobs, you're never going to knit it all together in the way that you need to have a balanced fundraising strategy. And when times are hard and you're looking at your costs, just by getting rid of the lot and just expecting your potential donor base to give you money because they feel like it, that isn't going to work.
No, it's very short-sighted.
Yeah.
I do commend, and I've got one client presently, really brave. I mean, they've had to face, it's a school, they've had to face £700,000 in redundancies to take costs out year on year, £700,000, and yet they're re-establishing their development office and recruiting a development director in the same financial year.
Yeah.
You can imagine how challenging that's been to communicate in the school, but what a brave bunch of governors. And boy, do I feel confident about where they're going as a school and, you know, that they'll be around in 10, 20 years from now.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. If you look at that sector, as we know, there'd be huge, particularly the independent school sector, where there's the additional, obviously, pressure now of the VAT on the school fees. But the reality is that some schools have said, no, we're going to maintain our levels of investment or increase our levels of investment in development because that is our way through this crisis. Others are just batting down the hatches and going, no, we're going to get rid of it all. And they are positioning their development staff in the same way as they might position the extra member of the grounds maintenance team or the extra member of the kitchen staff or whatever it might be. And so they're trying to be fair.
Of course.
In the way that they manage redundancies. But in trying to be fair, of course, they're really missing what the actual ambition of redundancies are, which is to make your business more efficient and more effective.
Yeah.
And getting rid of your fundraising and not investing in your development department does not sound to me, or does not seem to me, to be an intelligent or effective thing to do.
It's about communicating positively when you have success in fundraising. It gives confidence across the whole supporter base of an organisation. If you can go out and say, look, we've done really well this year. Thank you for your support. We've raised this much money. And it validates the development office role, but it actually also, it's good for the supporters. It's not the other way around. Yeah. You don't need to look as poor and impoverished and desperate to raise money. It's quite the reverse, isn't it? It's about vision and
we talk about the language of opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly. So these are really challenging times and we recognize that with our clients. Now, of course, you need to be efficient. You need to be very focused when you're making an investment to measure its performance and the expectations around returns. And if they're not being met, to face those challenges and make the necessary changes. But it is a really important mindset to start and think about this as investment rather than cost management.
Absolutely. And I think that extends through to external support, external advice, mentoring, guidance, whatever it might be. You know, sometimes it is necessary because you need that professional experience. You wouldn't build a house without employing an architect.
Well, some try, but it's not.
Well, absolutely. You know, but that's the reality of it. Yeah. You know, if you want to, if you wouldn't design something on a, you know, I could draw a house on a piece of paper, but I couldn't, I'm pretty damn sure it wouldn't stay up. You know, so I would have to go and employ an architect.
Yeah.
And actually, if you want to have an effective fundraiser, don't waste your money hoping that somebody's going to raise money. Get the work done properly to make sure your strategy is the right one for your institution, and then recruit the right staff to do it, and then it's a proper investment.
I think on the plus side, though, we are seeing a bit of a shift in how people value professional fundraising, either consultancy or in-house. That, you know, over recent years, people do seem to see it a bit more as of a profession. I do think that we will, as we kind of hit challenging economic times, see the age-old commission-based fundraising question crop up more and more, which obviously we will never do. But I think positively there is a shift and people do start to see the value in it more.
So just for the benefit of listeners, to be clear, that is where you remunerate your fundraising staff or teams based on a percentage of the amount that they bring in cash terms.
Yeah.
The difficulties around that are actually not just ethical, and they are considerable, but also legally, because the Charities Act makes it very clear that every time any fundraiser working on that basis speaks to a donor, they have to start the conversation by saying what percentage of any gift that they may ultimately give they're going to receive.
Can you imagine what that must feel like? I'm here today to ask you for £100,000, but I'm going to take 10% of it.
Yeah.
I'll get 10%, which will, you know, pay the mortgage. And the cause you want to support is going to get 90,000. So that's all right, isn't it?
Yeah. It also really doesn't recognise that the gift is being made because of the relationship with the whole institution, not how effective one person is asking. And there's so many other players that are involved in that cultivation and ask as well. It's just a big mistake.
It's a no-no. And thankfully, it is recognised in our industry that it's a no-no as well. Yeah. But again, I think by people who, certainly responsible organisations and responsible individuals within our industry, know that that is not something you propose. And quite frankly, if I was recruiting a fundraising person and somebody came to me and suggested that that's how they were going to work, I can see why it might be tempting to the people that control the purse strings.
But
be very wary.
Well, it immediately shows they don't really know what they're talking about. But what signals to me that they do know, what will attract the best professional fundraiser to your organisation is if you have thought through what those KPIs are.
Mm.
If you start on the basis of, as Amy, you said earlier, we need 50 contacts in the next 6 months. We have a database of X thousand, you know, then I think a professional fundraiser will say, well, hang on, I think they know what they're talking about. Don't you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you can tick off the meetings, you can have all those. And I think we've all been around this long enough to know that if you have 50 meetings with well-identified major gift prospects,
money will follow.
Money will follow.
It definitely will.
And it may not follow a meeting one.
No, no.
But that, again, is why you need to have the staff that can maintain those relationships.
Those 50 meetings are keeping you very busy.
But those 50 meetings, if you, we talk a lot, don't we, in this country about American philanthropy and how that works. The reality is the big successful fundraising institutions in America will have teams of people, and each individual will concentrate on a network of people.
And well, even our universities do that, our major universities, don't they?
They definitely do.
Yeah, because they've in effect picked up good practice from America, but they build relationships.
Yeah.
And then when that donor or prospective donor is in a place where he or she can give, what do? They go back to the person who they've got the relationship with and say, right, I can now help
you. So logical. Yeah. But when you're facing tough times and you're having to make this really difficult decisions around your where your finances stand, the last thing you want to do is cut that person out who's got those relationships.
I understand why it happens.
Yeah.
Right. I understand that if you're cutting teaching staff at a school, but you're maintaining your development office, that some people might go, well, have we got our priorities right?
Mm.
But the simple fact is there are no classrooms. You're not building new classrooms without raising money.
Yeah.
You know, even down to the nitty gritty of computers and books, if you want to make it really present, they all cost money. Everything costs money.
Of course.
And if school fees are being squeezed and schools' income's being squeezed, the only way you're going to start to generate additional money is through philanthropy. And therefore, it's an investment.
Amy, your final thoughts as we wrap? Anything we've missed?
Oh, just to say, you know, it is challenging and we are there for people to come and chat to. And if they want advice on what their structure should look like in terms of what they need in-house, our doors are always open, aren't they, to advise our friends in the charity sector about what might be the best route forward for them.
And Chris, thank you. I mean, there are also our professional associations like IDP that have got a wealth of information to give guides, haven't they?
Yeah. Well,
I think it's you know, the bottom line is that if you've got a good case for support, you can fundraise. But you can't do it on a wish and a prayer. You have to do it properly.
Mm.
And to do it properly is going to take some sort of investment. And therefore, boards of trustees, boards of governors, council members, whoever it might be, please do not think that you can just go out there and go, snap your fingers, and the money's going to come flowing in, because it won't.
I think that's got to be our Christmas card photo. The three of us dressed up as fairies with magic wands and tutus.
Chris, absolutely. That would
be quite a look, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't most of our clients love us if we just turned up with the magic bullet and sprinkle the fairy dust, and suddenly money will grow from the magic money tree.
Thank you, Chris Goldie and Amy Stevens, for joining us today on the Gifted Talks fundraising. And we look forward to speaking next at our next podcast. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for pulling up a chair and joining our conversation today. Please share any comments or even pose some questions for future episodes by emailing us at inquiries@giftedphilanthropy.com.